Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
This is Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. We have another first Thursday of the month, and I'm getting some feedback on the air, but hopefully we'll clear that up. And we're so pleased and grateful to have Greg Glazer from California, constitutional law expert, calling in with us as our co-host and our regular co-host for the Vaccination and Your Rights show with Alan Phillips. We're going to be talking about nanotechnology, mandated vaccinations, and the law and your rights, things that you really should learn about in case of an emergency, in case of pandemics, or anything else. We have heard recently inklings that the flu season has begun, along with the hurricane season. And so the winds are blowing. We're going to be, I'm looking forward to actually what we're going to be talking about today. Today is September 1st, the beginning of this month, and in honor of Labor Day, we should begin to learn a little bit more about how to protect ourselves. So without further ado, I would like to take one moment to say that we have a regular show on Monday when there is not an emergency happening to talk about the Organon of Medicine, to study homeopathy, and learn what Hahnemann lays out in this wonderful piece of literature, aphorism by aphorism, how to practice medicine. And he was a genius, and we need to continue to learn from him. We will be having an upcoming show October 6th with Christina Chambreau, a homeopathic veterinarian, and I hope that this will be a little series of talks with her. Homeopathy World Community is a public broadcasting system, I like to say, that this is open to everyone to listen to these shows. It does not cost anything, but we would love some donations to keep us going. And on Sunday evening, to start off the new week, I do a meditation, a 30-minute meditation that I think I've been receiving quite a few comments and comments of gratitude. So I am ready to begin with this particular show about nanotechnology. Do you want to start us off, Greg? Are we hearing sound?
Oh, yeah. Hi. Sure. So thanks for that introduction. And nanotechnology is very important to what's happening in the realm of vaccines because there is the potential that certain nanotechnologies like carbon tubules can be used to deliver vaccination elements at a nano level, which would interact with DNA in the body. And this poses practical issues, health issues, and legal issues as well. So one of the things we can talk about today is some of the legal issues. But I suppose I could intro with a little bit of the scientific background if you think that would be helpful.
I think so, because maybe people are not fully aware of what's happening in the realm of science and technology, how small things can get and how they can impede on the skin and on our bodies without us even knowing about it.
Right.
And Greg,
right.
Just for general background purposes, if you can give us even informally a definition of what nanotechnology is, or some general examples of what it encompasses, as sort of a floor to stand on with the more specific details that I'm sure you'll be getting into.
Yeah, sure. You know, essentially, a nanomolecule is anything that operates at a incredibly small level in the body, and it's commonly associated with high technology. But realistically, even when you burn a log on the fire, it creates something that affects you at the nano level. So we're constantly inundated with molecules at the nano level, which man changes through his activities, that go as simple as painting a fence to burning a log on the fire. But laboratories today are also engaging in a more specific type of nanotechnology involving creating structures that interact at the DNA level, like as I mentioned, carbon nanotubules and other types of technologies that will they're like genetic technologies that will trigger a particular gene to act in a particular way. Like there are thousands of genes in the body, but not all of them are active, so they can be turned on or off if you stimulate them. And we also know that DNA can mutate. And so the specifics of this aren't particularly that relevant for legal purposes, you know, because it doesn't really matter whether a slight defect in the DNA is causing like a copying error, or whether it's actually like mutating the DNA. For legal purposes, it just sort of analyze it as is this operating at such a small level that it is difficult to discern what's happening. So an example in the legal realm that might be useful would be how asbestos has been regulated. Now, asbestos is a chemical or it's a property that's occurs naturally in some instances and occurs unnaturally in others. And it's a very small fiber that will attach to the lungs and isn't filtered out. So it just stays there. And this example is useful because we know that society has tried to regulate asbestos. First, it was through tort claims, and then it resulted in uncertainty as the experts tried to testify as to, you know, what the asbestos was causing, and uncertain damages, and big settlements. Some statutory compensation schemes were proposed. And so the asbestos example is a useful one for analyzing nanotechnology in the modern era. And according to the Columbia Journal of Environmental Law, there's almost no federal or state law specifically designed to regulate nanomaterials. Now, that was recently the EPA proposed a rule to require manufacturers of nanotechnology to notify the EPA before they commence creating these substances that may be hazardous to human health. And it allows the EPA to have an opportunity to evaluate them and then possibly limit the activity before it occurs. Now, this was just proposed in June of 2011. But specifically for our purposes of vaccines, there is actually an exception to that recently proposed rule, because there's an exception in the law for emergencies. When you have an emergency declared by the at the federal level, the authorities are allowed to the FDA specifically is allowed to approve without further testing an unapproved drug for insertion into a vaccine. We saw this example with the H1N1 situation. You guys would probably remember this better than I would, but there was a drug called Primaveral or something like that. And It was approved by the Secretary, Department of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. So she approved this, and it was pursuant to this particular law, Section 564 of the FFDCA. And it allows, you know, again, it allows the FDA to approve an unapproved drug for insertion in the event you have a declared emergency. Now, for those who review independent media, you know, we know that it doesn't take much to get the authorities to declare an emergency. They're quick.
We found that out in really disturbing degree with the swine flu pandemic, which we later found out, at least from European mainstream sources, if not here in the U.S., that we really didn't have a pandemic at all. Of course, many of us were kind of screaming that chant as it played out along. But I still have seen no recognition whatsoever of that from any authoritative sources in the U.S., none that I'm aware of, despite that. And just a real quick comment, if I may, Greg, it's so disturbing to any of us who have concerns about the safety and appropriateness of routine immunizations. The concern goes up, potentially skyrockets when you're talking about emergency vaccines that are fast-tracked, meaning they're made in a much shorter period of time, they're produced, and with little or no testing. And as you are describing, they get around that, of course, because of the emergency declaration. They get around it legally. And yet, ironically, as I've pointed out repeatedly in the past, in most states we have even fewer rights to refuse emergency vaccines than we do routine vaccines. And so at a time when, from a concern about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines generally, where you have even greater concerns, that is with fast-tracked emergency vaccines, we have even less right in many instances to refuse them. Exemptions in many cases can go out the window if an emergency is declared. So it's all very troubling. And on that pleasant note, let me turn it back over to you, Greg.
Yeah, sure. And I'll actually speak directly to that point by quoting the Congressional Research Service on whether or not exemptions will protect you in the event of an emergency. And here is the quote. Okay. Current federal regulations do not include any mandatory vaccination programs. Rather, measures such as quarantine and isolation are generally utilized to halt the spread of communicable diseases. If a person refuses to be vaccinated, he or she may be quarantined during the public health emergency, giving rise to the vaccination order. Now, so this is directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak. This is the Congressional Research Service, which has reviewed the current precedent of laws. Now, I take strong issue with regard to their interpretation, but all the same, you know, this is what their interpretation is. And so that
interpretation of the
laws that might authorize any type of mandatory vaccination program. So essentially, to do sort of a recap here, the law does not mandate vaccination, whether in an emergency or otherwise, provided that you are conducting your life in an independent manner. That means you're using your exemption, you know, whether it's on philosophical grounds or religious grounds or moral grounds. And if you are conducting yourself in a way that you are not entering into these portals of government and society that would require you to be vaccinated. I mean, that's like going into the public square, becoming a healthcare worker, so forth. Now, there are limited exceptions for healthcare workers, you know, to have their own exemptions, and we can discuss those. But that's just sort of an overview. So,
I just want to point out that because I'm not sure if I quite understand what you're saying. There are state laws. And the reason the federal law doesn't have any mandatory vaccine programs is because the federal government lacks authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. So that's why all the school exemption, vaccine requirement exemption laws, for example, are at the state law level, because they concern state residents. And you'll see the federal government mandate vaccines in the military and immigration and other federal contexts. But there are state laws that do pretty explicitly throw exemptions out the window in a declared emergency. So are you saying that states that say that are overstepping their lawful boundaries?
Yes.
Okay, I want to be clear because I want people to understand that, and I'm not disagreeing with your point at all. I'm all ears today and eager to hear and listen and learn from you, as I always do, Greg, and always love having you on the show for that and reason. But where one is in a state that has a law that in whatever specific language it has, it says exemptions go out the window, and if that state declares an emergency and mandates vaccines, I think the question of whether somebody would tie you down and enforce it because the law says you don't have an exemption is a separate question, and I think that's less likely to happen than not. But I think it does raise an interesting hypothetical in terms of what do you do if you believe or understand the law to say one thing, but there's a local official who has a different understanding of the law and is saying something else. But anyway, thank you for the point of clarification there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's I have yet to find a state that has a mandatory vaccination law that does not have an exemption to it. And then even where you have a very narrow exemption, those exemptions can be challenged and broadened. There are some court opinions that take a liberal view of exemptions and therefore will, you know, in order to protect rights, they'll read exemptions very broadly. In order to, and there was one in particular that came up, it was in Colorado recently, where said that a religious exemption is only valid if you have a like a statement of approval from a clergyman in your chapter or church, and that would be an example of an unconstitutional exemption because the exemption is not broad enough. A person's right to religion doesn't depend on the sanction or approval of a priest.
Amen.
Yes. All right.
Pun intended.
And so, and that comes from Supreme Court authority that looks to the validity of a person's religious belief. The sincerity of a person's religious belief is one of the questions analyzed by the Supreme Court, but one's sincerity doesn't depend on another person's approval. And so that's how we would analyze it legally. So the short answer is that there are no mandatory vaccination laws in America. The long answer is that there are laws that look like mandatory vaccination laws, but there are exemptions to those laws. And if you know,
yeah, but not every. I really do take it. This is an issue that comes up a lot in the anti-vaccine circles, and I'm going to challenge you on this, Greg, because I think it's not just about playing with words, because there are not laws that everybody, there are not exemption laws that apply to everybody in every state. And not everybody can qualify for an exemption. And so, therefore, and I think just a question of the order of logic here, that the starting place is that the law says you have to be vaccinated, and it's only if and after that that you have and qualify for an exercise an exemption that you then are excluded from the mandate. The concern I have with phrasing it the other way around, that therefore people start with sort of a conclusion, which first of all I think is incorrect, but not even just as a technical matter, but starting out with therefore there aren't any mandatory vaccine laws, is it carries an implication that you don't necessarily have to do anything because they're not mandated. And exemptions, generally, I can tell you one curious exception to this in terms of the wording of a law, but generally I believe have to be proactively exercised or they don't take effect. And so so it concerns me. I don't know that it's literally incorrect, but it concerns me when I hear folks say that because there are exemptions, there aren't mandates. And I really think it's the other way around, that there are mandates, but some people, and not all, can qualify for an exemption.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, I think you're directing us to also is, mm-hmm. is the writing on the wall here. For those who recognize the history of emergency declarations and public health measures, they'll also see that things move very quickly. And so if you're not proactive about protecting your exemption rights, then you can quickly find yourself lost in the legal fray of trying to explain why you are not vaccinated. And so those who do see this writing on the wall, which Alan is discussing, should be proactive by analyzing and preparing a vaccine exemption form, and then possibly also aligning yourself with a medical professional who can take a look at the ingredients of a vaccine and look at your current, your current state of body, and do an assessment and say, is it wise to put squalene in this person's body? And any vaccine that has squalene is going to cause an adverse reaction to this person. And if you can have that as part of your medical exemption for vaccination, as well as any other additional bases for your exemption, such as religious, and if you have these stated in your vaccine exemption form and you have that handy, then you are a prepared individual for the time when an emergency comes. Because you can see the writing on the wall. You know that chemicals like mercury, pollutants and toxins like mercury and squalene are likely to be used in vaccines. And if you know that these things will harm your body and cause an adverse reaction to you, then you can have an assessment done on you.
Well,
that's for you.
Can I jump in a little bit? I feel like maybe you can tell us your stand, your platform. I feel, Alan, that you are a very practical and realistic and hands-on person working with those people who are in need of exemptions and vaccines in today's contemporary society. And Greg, I feel that this is my perspective on what I hear, that being an idealist, there is a lot of theoretical stuff going on, and the idea of having these forms prepared is great. It sounds like, when you go to the hospital, you fill out a whole bunch of forms, whether what you want to, the medical society to do with you when you're in a certain situation, or preparing a will, things like this. We don't have, as far as I know, maybe Alan, you could correct me, specific forms of this nature that are recognized by the governments and the persons in charge of administering these vaccinations. And, of course, it sounds like also you gave a step in the direction of a medical waiver, whereas in some places that's more difficult to get. And the other one is a religious or personal vaccine waiver, and that each person should have these forms filled out when they're first born by their parents or when they turn 18. This seems to be the direction it's going.
Let me jump in, because there's several points there, Debbie, and all good ones, of course, as usual. As with routine immunizations, I'm just going to generalize Greg's use of the word form a little bit. Some states have forms and some don't, but whether you call it a form or not, the point is, and Greg's point, which is a really good one, is that even if you, I think, now Greg, of course, correct me if I'm misinterpreting you, but I think at least part of what you're getting at here is that whether or not you have an immediate present need for a form or your statement of beliefs or whatever it is you need in your particular state or situation that qualifies you for the exemption, that if you're prepared with that ahead of time, then if something does come up, if there is an emergency declared and catches you off guard, then you're not wondering, oh, wait a minute, how do I get an exemption? And you have to go research it and look it up, maybe hire an attorney or whatever you have to do, but maybe you don't have time if it shows up in an emergency. There is a separate question about whether or not and how to whether exemptions apply in emergency, and if so, do you exercise them differently, and so forth. And yet a further question that nobody can really predict with any precision in advance, who's going to be behaving in what way on any side of the issue in the context of an emergency where people tend to panic and sometimes act more out of fear or panic than rational thinking. But we can only prepare so far in advance, you know, with hypothetical situations. But I wanted to make a quick comment on the medical, because like the religious, the specifics with medical exemptions can vary from state to state or situation to situation. For example, I've had nurses come to me who, as employees in a hospital, have a medical doctor who's recommending that they don't get vaccinated, and the hospital administration says, well, we don't agree with that opinion, and you have to get vaccinated or you can't work here. It is sometimes difficult with a medical exemption. I know with regarding the children in school, in some states, if a doctor makes the recommendation, that's the end of it due to the wording of the statute. And there has even been at least one state appellate court case on medical exemption on that exact point, that the statute said, in effect, if the doctor makes the recommendation, the child is exempt. And the state wanted to get more information, and the appellate court ultimately said, nope, can't do that. So, whether it's just a matter of the doctor's recommendation or requires some further kind of qualification, or whether or not the state can challenge it. There was an appellate case in New York on a medical exemption where ultimately the child was denied the exemption, and it looked to me like on the practical level, it boiled down to there wasn't any published medical study saying that a child with this condition is at risk from a vaccine, even though the child's doctor adamantly believed the child should not be vaccinated. It's as if to say, it's like when you hear that they don't put up a stoplight until somebody gets hurt or killed in an accident at the intersection, then they say, okay, now we have to put up a stoplight or a stop sign or whatever. And similar sort of thing here in a disturbing way. Until somebody is hurt and it gets written up in a medical publication on this particular syndrome or condition or disease, you know, it's not going to qualify as a medical exemption. So and not as a point of disagreement, just one of clarification, that sometimes it can be easy to get a medical or religious exemption. You know, for example, with religious, sometimes you have to explain your beliefs, sometimes you don't, and other times not so easy.
Okay.
Yeah. Did I leave anything out there, Debbie, that you...
No, it sounds very good, and I agree with you. Too many times, and everybody has experienced this in their neighborhood, if there isn't a stop sign on a corner and we have many, many accidents, the local government is slow to act, to put up that stop sign where it is needed. And the same thing, people will be getting hurt before any action is taken. And for this particular issue, we know that there's a lot of political shenanigans and money involved and greed involved, and that's why things are even slower. And that is also why the general population who is interested in this particular issue has to start being vocal, talking about it with each other, forming organizations. And there are organizations, the NVIC that we've spoken about in previous radio shows. Things are active in your state, and if you want to be part of it to protect your rights, then give them a call, because we know it's going to take a lot of energy and effort on the part of the general population to make any kind of change in the status quo.
And it may be that the emergency happens or the change happens, and I think that's actually quite likely. When President George Bush Jr. was asked whether he had his flu shot one year, he said, no, and I do not intend to. I think what we're looking at here with vaccines is a massive conspiracy. And people in power who are in the know realize that vaccines are incredibly harmful. They're meant for the mass populace. And I think that the people in power will just, you know, hire their own doctors to say that they got the shots when they actually don't. And, the rest of us have to navigate through the vaccine exemption process. And so, you know, again, if you do choose to go to a doctor and you want to do this legitimately, and I think that's important, then what you do is you go, you know, you find a medical doctor, ideally a medical doctor, but, you know, if you can't find a medical doctor, then a naturopathic doctor and a licensed ND, and just ask them to prepare a statement that's signed by them, which says that they understand, they've done an examination of the risks and benefits of the chemicals that are inside common vaccinations, and they should list them. You know, it's aluminum hydroxide, amphotericin B, formaldehyde, et cetera, et cetera. And then they just do a quick examination. You know, what's the risk factor and what's the vaccination element that would apply to that risk factor, and then draw a conclusion at the end of it, which is, you know, which may ultimately end up being that the ingredients are not safe for injection into the body of my patient, and therefore, I'm recommending that the patient be monitored by my care, you know, and that in the event that situation changes where my patient does need to reassess this, I will take the necessary action. And that may be sufficient for your medical exemption and may be helpful to have that reviewed as well legally.
You know, my consultations with people on exemptions and waivers sometimes have a strict kind of legal analysis and then sort of a practical real-world component in that regard, especially when people first started contacting me during the swine flu pandemic, and that was the first time I had really looked at the emergency context legally and started realizing there were problems in terms of the rights potentially being different and so forth. But one of the things I say to people is, you know, particularly in that context, found myself saying is, well, because people would be calling me from around the country and saying, hey, what do I do if they mandate these vaccines? And upon looking into it, I found that there wasn't nearly as much that they could do as I would like to be able to tell them in terms of just the language of the laws in place at the time and still. And so, you know, the legal analysis, you know, might be that you don't, there really isn't anything you can do. The exemptions go out the window, dot, dot, dot. But at the bottom line, at the end of the day, you do whatever you have to do. So technically, do I think somebody has a constitutional right from a legal analysis point of view, if someone comes to the door and says there's been an emergency declared, you need to get your vaccine? Maybe not, but does that mean they shouldn't argue that they have one? Heck yeah. You know, I mean, you use whatever you've got, and the first line of defense usually is if you have a clear legal argument, you make it, of course, but many times it's not clear or potentially even absent. Does that mean you give up? No. You know, when you're in a society where your government is out of control, corruption is rampant, whatever you want to call it, however you want to phrase it, but when what's going on is clearly and fundamentally wrong, I think we have a moral and ethical and even a spiritual obligation to take a stand on the side of what we believe and know to be right and proper. And you may or may not win, depending on whether, you know, the total set of circumstances. But if somebody was at my door and I was at a time and place where I thought the law didn't give me a right, but I didn't want to get the vaccine, you're darn right, I'm going to argue it's against the Constitution, whether I honestly or analytically think that that's I think one could argue it's against the intent of the Constitution, whether or not however you might interpret the actual law to be at the moment. But, you know, would having a letter from a doctor be a good thing to do? You know, it may or may not work, but does that mean don't get it? No, it doesn't. I guess what I'm trying to say is pull together all the resources you have, and hopefully one or the combination of them will do you in good stead. And that's, you know, as an attorney, I never advise anybody to lie, but occasionally I'll take off the attorney hat and say, you know, parent to parent, at the end of the day, you do whatever you have to do to protect your kids.
Can I jump in? Oh, go ahead.
Sure. No, go ahead.
I wanted to just jump in here and get on the topic of the nanotechnology and especially the influenza vaccine, because obviously the R&D is going into this smaller and smaller and easier methods of getting people to take these types of medications, whether they're inhalants through the nostrils, who knows where they go when they go straight up into your brain, and also, which, you know, it seems like this is much easier. People who are afraid of needles, they don't even have to get a needle. They just take a little puff into their nose of some spray, and it's easy to do. So that's one thing that I have a concern about. The other thing is the nanotechnologies that these particles, as Greg indicated, get smaller and smaller. So things could be out there that you do not even know are touching you. So I have an article from 2010. It was from the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, about the Liquidia technologies that they started, and that's a year ago, so I'm sure that they've further progressed. They had raised $25 million in financing this year to test the seasonal flu vaccine at adults aged over 65. And the Liquidia is also developing cancer treatments and other products based on this nanotechnology research. The founder happens to be Joseph DeSimone, a chemist at NC State University in UNC Chapel Hill. And they say that the flu vaccine is going to require many years of clinical testing. I'm wondering who's going to be those guinea pigs for those types of technologies. But this type of thing is out there.
We find that in nanotechnology, the use of adjuvants, which is what stimulates your immune system in to react or overreact, is the primary source for nanotech. So, like, there's this one company in Europe. It's called HCVax. It's a European joint project, and this is from a 2011 news story. And they are developing a vaccination against Hep C, and which affects 170 million people apparently. And the their vaccine, what they're doing is they're developing a gel. It's like this nano gel, and it's again it's an adjuvant. And they're in the point here where they are ready to get this thing going and market it. And so
when you go into your store and they have samples out there of creams and gels and things like that, and you don't read the label or know exactly what's in there, there could very easily be these minute particles.
And when it gets at that level of such a small particle, we wonder as well whether it is something that could become airborne.
That's true. Yeah. I have a question regarding all of these about just the idea of disclosure. I mean, are we being told, are we giving an agreement to someone by taking these things, the big signs in the grocery store, in the pharmacy, they're going to be giving you these vaccinations. Come get it today. And are they giving you some sort of rights reading before you get that?
Yeah, you know, I imagine that they could, you know, do something like that. There was that law passed recently at the federal level which gave immunity to vaccine makers. Like something along similar lines. You know, I think more people are opting out of vaccines than ever before today. But
right.
There's also another interesting phenomenon of people gravitating toward public health measures in the event of an emergency. I mean, really, it only takes a couple stories from CNN to reverse that tide. So, you know, I'm not really optimistic.
I don't feel like I got my answer about disclosure.
Yeah.
I mean, is it in place? Are we being told what our body is getting in contact with?
Well, you know, as I discussed earlier, there's that EPA rule regarding that the manufacturer of the nanotechnology has to give the EPA notice, and then that this chemical substance may be hazardous to human health. And then after that 90-day notice period, EPA will have the opportunity to evaluate the intended use and, if necessary, prohibit or limit the activity before it occurs. And the EPA may find that the way to limit the activity is by providing a consumer notice or requiring a consumer notice. So the EPA would have the authority in that specific instance. Now, we could analyze it at the local level. For example, the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, CDTSC, they're one of the most active agencies in the regulation of nanomaterials. And they have issued a formal information request under the California Health and Safety Code, and it asks manufacturers and producers, importers of carbon nanotubes to provide information on the materials that are handled, the safety protocols, detection methods, and even risk data. So what they do is, you know, they analyze the risk data, and then they will determine, you know, what actions to take. You know, and they already have the general authority to protect the public and regulate toxic chemicals. Like, you know, just look at Prop 65. You know, you have all those cancer warnings that come out. So it follows the same type of process. And even some local governments have tried to regulate nanotechnology. Like Berkeley, California, they were the first municipality that adopted an ordinance that requires companies and labs in their area that are handling nanomaterials to submit annual reports that contain information regarding the toxicity and use of the nanomaterials. So the theme here is that nanomaterials are being examined for risk because there's a lack of data on how they affect the public. You know, and just look back. You know, this is your DDT. This is your Agent Orange. This is your asbestos. We don't know.
Yeah, but the answers are always too late. Too many hundreds, if not thousands, of people are usually harmed in the process of getting this data out and of somebody taking an action. And very often there's a political undertone that does not get this information into the hands of the public.
Oh, yeah. And you know who wrote a book about this specific topic, actually, Debbie, is Gary Matsumoto. He's that New York-based award-winning investigative journalist. And he wrote this book called Vaccine A, the covert government experiment that's killing our soldiers and why GIs are only the first victims. And he looked at, you know, why the Pentagon is denying Gulf War syndrome, and he looked specifically to squalene adjuvants in vaccines. And he called them nanobombs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this premise, and even the Soviets called the squalene a type of biological time bomb because it triggers your immune system. And even though squalene itself is this sort of natural thing in your body, when you insert too much of it into the body, it becomes incredibly unsafe. And so it just like causes your system to overreact, and it harms your immune system in the long run. And
People are out there writing about it, but who is listening? This is the question.
Right. I mean, I think there's a contingent that is listening. I think that if you are a person who eats organically and exercises and does a lot to take care of their body, you can probably go and get vaccinated, and you might not even see much problem in your body because you are supplementing your system in order to make sure that you are strong enough that your immune system can take it. I mean, the body is resilient with its filters, and even science, with all of its dangers, won't be able to affect you too much if you're really taking care of your body. But if you find yourself in a society that has a prolonged emergency that threatens the food supply and causes a great deal of stress to people, over the long run, add vaccines to that and a lack of healthy, nutritious food, you're going to see a very, very serious health crisis that just perpetuates itself, leading to mass.
We already see the health crisis. We see the increase in ADHD, in autism, in obesity, in diabetes, in heart disease, in cancer. The epidemics are everywhere. We're a weakened people. And I agree with you that we have to do things to boost our immune systems. And now the supplements are being handled so that we can't get them in certain parts of the world. So this is really, we are in crisis mode right now, but we have to not play to the fear and the panic that some of the forces propose us to react to by getting these types of impositions on our body. So,
right, right.
Do you have any other books like this one that you told us about vaccine A?
Yes, definitely. If you go to my constitutional analysis memo, which you can find at Pandemic Response Project, I list up. There's parts of it that's just like a compendium of resources where you can examine the dangers of vaccines. And, a lot of materials are, if you're particularly interested in technical reports in medical journals written by doctors who have blown the whistle, go to thinktwice.com. That's a really helpful place to begin your research. But if you're looking for more of like a big picture about vaccines, then a good place to start might be someone like Eustace Mullins, Murder by Injection, Vaccines, Are They Really Safe? By Neil Miller. That's a really good one. The Virus and the Vaccine by Debbie Bookchin and Jim Schumacher. I already talked about the Gary Matsumoto book. Sherry Tenpenny has written quite a bit, What CDC Documents and Science Reveal About Vaccination. So the information is definitely out there. And whether the public is ready to accept that the public has been lied to by the medical establishment is yet to be seen. I don't think it's likely. I think people gravitate toward the institutional structure. And once the emergency is declared, the access to information and the ability to challenge that institutional structure is highly limited. And so that's why I talk so much about the writing that's on the wall. This information has been out for decades and nothing has changed. So when the stakes are higher and we're gravitating ever closer to these declared emergencies, I wouldn't wait for society to change. It's time to take a proactive approach to your health and to your legal rights. And that means trying to live organically and trying to understand the vaccine exemption process. And ultimately what these federal and state laws say is that if you refuse the vaccine, then, pursuant to an exemption, then the government is allowed to take other measures that will limit the risk of cross-contamination. So, let's say there's a Hep C outbreak or some outbreak, and you refuse vaccination, then you might submit to being tested for the for having the virus. But they might say, well, even if you test negative for the virus, it may be that you'll be able to get it, an hour after we leave. So they might say, okay, well, the only measure we can take to protect the public is you have to submit to quarantine or isolation. Now, those two words have two different legal meanings. Quarantine is where you go into a camp with other people. You're put together, just think concentration camp. That's what quarantine is. Isolation is something different. Isolation is where you are separate from other people. That's like a cell, like your own separate cell or containment unit. And they may find that it's just impractical, too costly to put people into isolation. And so the way that these things would be handled from my reading of the current regulations as well as from the Model Emergency Health Act, which is being proposed, is that you just have...
What is the Model Emergency Health Act? I don't know of this. What is that?
Yeah, it's this... basically a proposed law that was, it's called the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And it was written by these guys like Gostin and Fidler who work behind the scenes for the medical military industrial complex, but you wouldn't know it because they work for like Georgetown University, but really that they get their funding from the military. And this proposed law sets the rules for states to enforce emergency regulations, emergency health care, and coordinate emergency utilities for public health. And what it says is that states will implement the recommendations of the higher ups, you know, at the federal level. And, you know, so if the feds say that you got to have, you know, everyone's got to take this vaccine, then the states will implement that. And if somebody refuses on the grounds of an exemption, then they can be put into quarantine or isolation. And if a person challenges the, like, the structure or the, like, the manner of their isolation or quarantine, then they have to go before a military tribunal, which essentially is like, you know, you get like a closed-door military hearing, you know, where you say, hey, look, it's unfair that I'm here. I should be able to go back to my home, or I don't like the food here. I'd like to be able to eat organically or something like that. And then, you know, it's just a closed-door military hearing. Like, just be like, you know, sorry, guy, you're out of luck. And in the event that you have a declaration of martial law pursuant to the, you know, the Constitution would suspend the right of habeas corpus under Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution. The privilege of the writ habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion public safety may require it. So if they suspended your right of habeas corpus, then you have no other way to challenge your military tribunal hearing. So you may end up in this, you know, prison for 2 years. And while you're in this prison, if it's uneconomical for you to have your own little cell, your own little isolation cell, you know, if they put you into the camp of everyone else, then what's to say that they won't take you know, mandatory health measures like forced vaccination? You know, one of the things that they tested in the Nazi concentration camps in World War II Germany was putting fluoride into the water. So this is according to my research. Put fluoride in the water, and what they found is that the inmates became far more docile, and therefore they needed less guards to monitor the concentration camps.
That's a whole nother topic, the fluoride, and we're all taking it. Well, I'm not, but
it raises a really good point, though. What he's talking about is that when you factor in economics, there can be compromises in other areas. You know, that they'll look at the advantage, quote unquote, of fewer guards, less money to do that, and that could cause someone to seriously downplay the concerns about possible toxic effects of long-term exposure to fluoride, because look, we can save money doing this. And what's really unfortunate in our current political system is that many, many things are driven by money, even on the surface. Forget about the money drives everything, you know, in the background that nobody knows about. I mean, just in terms of laws going into place. I mean, I have often thought that the mandatory seatbelt law is more about the state getting money every time they catch somebody without their seatbelt on, because they can pull them over and give them a ticket here in North Carolina for, I don't know, what is it, $75 or more, than it was about some sort of fundamental rights issue or safety, because if you're not wearing your seatbelt, that in and of itself doesn't put anybody else at risk. You know, so for me, as a rights issue, you shouldn't have to do that. But you know, the point that I'm making, that I think is one aspect of what Greg is saying, is that a lot of things that are problematic on a more philosophical level in terms of rights and what rights should or shouldn't be can get compromised by what's going to save the state money.
Right. Money is at the bottom of it all. Okay, so
power, really.
We have about four minutes left to the show. And was there anything else dealing with the health freedom, nanotechnology, and the oppressive methods that falsely interpret vaccine mandates in emergency regulations? And then I'd like Alan to talk about your ebook for those people who are looking for some assistance.
Yeah. I'll speak really quickly to the point about interpretation. So it's important to know that the government uses broad and sweeping language when it reserves to itself this power to provide public health assistance and regulate public health threats. So it's really the power of interpretation is governed by politics. So when you have a smattering of law, I mean, there's so many emergency regulations, it's obscene. And so it's going to be incredibly confusing in an emergency to determine, you know, what are the governing documents, who are the governing authorities, and which are, what are the instructive documents. And I can tell you from experience that what government officials will do and public health officials will do is they will just look to the instructive documents. They'll go to the CDC website. They'll look at the FAQ sheet. They're not going to be reading the laws to determine your constitutional rights. You know, it's just like, you know, when I was in litigation, you know, when I was trying to figure out how to conduct a trial or do documents in preparation for a trial, it was, I would read treatises. I wouldn't, like, go and read the code books verbatim. That's just how it's done. And so you can expect the same, a similar type of thing. So have to be proactive about protecting your individual rights, because the writing is on the wall as for how these things will be interpreted, and they will be interpreted generally against your or individual rights.
I think that sounds like a good show for the next time you're up again in the next month. So, Alan, just give us a quickie about your ebook, and it can be found on Homeopathy World Community on the front page.
Right, and I tell you, real briefly here, Attorney Greg Glazer's Memorandum on the Constitutionality of Forced Vaccination During Martial Law Outbreak or Pandemic, incredibly well-researched document that I really encourage folks to read. It's on linked on the homepage of the PandemicResponseProject.com site. The ebook, Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, information about how the law works generally and exemption and waiver law specifically in a dozen or more different contexts, schools and military and immigration and healthcare employees and so forth and so on. Only document I know of anywhere that really goes into some depth and is written by an attorney experienced in this arena myself. Try to update it every year or two as changes in the law dictate, but a really good starting place to understand, to have the information you need to make informed decisions about exemptions and waivers.
Sounds good. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening. This is an archive show that you can download and listen to at your leisure. We're going to, again, hear from Alan next Thursday. He's going to send me the topic of interest, and we've just finished cases, and we're going to probably continue with that. So thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you, Debbie.
Bye-bye.
Thank you as well.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Thank you.
world. Why?